Hi, I'm Ed Stetzer. I want to welcome you to another edition of The Exchange, where we have conversations with ministry leaders, thinkers, to really help pastors and church leaders, our audience, to know the context, know the culture, and engage it more faithfully. We're going to talk in just a minute with our guests. Before we do, let me just mention real quickly that there seems to be a bit of a narrative out there that Christianity is in decline in North America. We often hear breathless reporters bringing forth another piece of research that say the nuns are the none of the above, who answer none of the above on the religion questions, that the nuns have become ascendant, and that Christianity is in steep decline. And part of these voices have become more and more loud over the last few months and years. I wrote an article recently in USA Today kind of pushing back on that notion just a bit, that perhaps we need to take a better look at the data and get a better picture of what's going on. Right about that time, I actually picked up or heard about a book and then got an advanced reader copy of the book. And this book is by Frank Newport. The book is called God is Alive and Well, and it's a statistical look at the kind of faith in America. And Frank, let me give a little bio for him. Frank is the editor-in-chief of Gallup, and Gallup is a well-known polling organization here. It goes back decades, actually. And if you're a Christian leader, you may have heard of Gallup and some of the research they've done on church and culture. But the reality is they're much more engaged in a broader sphere, in a broader realm. When I did some consulting for Lowe's a few years ago, Lowe's Home Improvement, we actually looked at, we used Gallup, for example, to in labor relations polling. And so that's a very, very, very broad and well-engaged organization. Well, the editor-in-chief of that organization is Frank Newport. And Frank joins me today via Skype from his home in New Jersey. And we're so excited to have him and talk with him a little bit about his new book, God is Alive and Well, The Future of Religion in America. Could you greet the folks, the pastors and church leaders who watch.
Greetings. Good to be with you today. My pleasure, Ed.
Good deal. Well, let's a little background on you. You have a PhD in sociology from the University of Michigan. You've been the past president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, well-known along the way. You blog at pollingmatters.gallup.com. I think many of us have seen you on TV. We've seen you, your articles, things of that sort. And you, of course, you live in Princeton with your wife, Kim, and have four kids. And Gallup's been involved in polling since 1935, and really about a third of a 350,000 interviews every year with Americans. At Lifeway Research is just a little teeny operation compared to what you do, but we've learned and been helped by some of your research. So what inspired you to write this book, God is Alive and Well, and why does it matter? Why should people care?
Well, it's a good question, and I might point out that Dr. George Gallup, who founded our company, who's not particularly religious himself, I don't believe. I didn't meet him. He died in 1984. Actually saw that religion was very important in American society and started asking Americans questions about it back when he started polling, 30s, 40s, but particularly in the 50s. His son, George Gallup Jr., who actually was very personally religious, who unfortunately just died in the last year or two, himself continued that tradition at Gallup, did a lot of polling, wrote a lot of books, spoke a lot about religion as measured using surveys. So I'm kind of following that tradition in Gallup, although I have a personal interest in religion myself, so I'm kind of marrying my personal interest in religion and my social science training to say, you know, we need to know more about what's going on in religion, because nobody, no matter how committed an atheist you might be out there, nobody can deny that in the U.S. and around the world, religion is extremely important to this day and has extremely important manifestations for everything anybody does.
You know, 2009, I call it the year of Christianity's predicted demise. I guess there were certain things that sort of came together. The ARIS, the American Religious Identification Survey, came out and indicated that over the past two decades, about 10% decline in those who identified as Christian. The Christian Science Monitor published a kind of a well-read, widely distributed article by Michael Spencer, and it was called The Coming Evangelical Collapse. And then John Meacham wrote that cover story on Newsweek, I think it was, called The Death of Christian America. And so all these things sort of came together, and again, in these breathless voices, people began to say, is the end near? And I wrote an article for CT on on Christians often behaving badly with statistics along the way. And when we look at the numbers, not maybe the interpretation of the numbers, we perhaps see a different picture of religiosity is what specifically we'd call it in the research field, but of the Christian faith as well. So talk to us about what you found when you wrote, and this is really based on over a million interviews over the course of the last few years, but what did you find when you wrote God is Alive and Well?
Well, you're right. We're very lucky here because we're doing interviewing every night with a client in Nashville called HealthWays, which is a company that's dedicated to trying to improve Americans' health and well-being in companies across the country. And that's great that we have that partnership. But as a result of our doing 1,000 interviews a night, we're able to put on that questionnaire, on that survey, several questions about religion. And since we've been doing that since 2008, that accumulates about 350,000 interviews a year, which gives us, as you say, over a million interviews, the most we've ever had in America, kind of studying these core questions about religion, the basic demographics. We don't have the chance on the survey to ask a lot of depth questions about religion. We do those in other surveys, but this gives us a real good estimate of the basic core questions in America. So that's what we're able to certainly to look at in greater detail than we've ever been able to before. By the way, as you probably know, the census doesn't ask about religion. They can't. So we really don't have that same valuable data that the census provides us on so much else in America about religion. So we have to look to private sources like Gallup to come up with that. So much has gone on in religion. You point out the lot of attention given to the rise of the nuns. And clearly things have been changing in religion. Different manifestations about how it's practiced. Religious historians who are watching can clearly go back to, you know, the time of Christ and notice how everything's changed over the years, and we're still changing. But I would say, and that's why I titled the book, God is Alive and Well, that we still are a very religious nation. We're still a very Christian nation. All but 5% of Americans who have a religious identification identify with the Christian faith. About 23% are Catholic. And we have about 52% who are non-Catholic Christian. I call those Protestants. And we have another 2% who are Mormon, with Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, has Jesus Christ in the name. So that totes up to about 77% of all Americans are Christian. And if you back out the 18% who don't have an explicit religious identity right off the bat, you're just left with about 5%, give or take, who identify with a non-Christian religion in this country. So we're very much still a Christian religion, a Christian nation.
Let's talk some about the nuns, because the nuns are those who fill out on a form, a survey, none of the above. I'm not this, I'm not that. And by the way, I agree with you about the census. I think it's a shame. I think that's one of the reasons we get some better data from, for example, the Canadian census. I was recently interacting some with the Brazilian census, and there's good research out there, but unfortunately, the United States Census doesn't ask religious questions. So the General Social Survey is one I've used a lot, but also Gallup resources are exceedingly helpful along the way. But one of the questions is about the nuns. Now I've kind of been of the view, my hypothesis, and we did some analysis in Christianity Today, that there's some correlation between really the decline of mainline Protestantism and the rise of the nuns. And so I want to talk a little about you, but you're actually pretty critical in the book about mainline Protestants, though you attend a mainline Protestant church, but you're also critical about mainline Protestants. So I like to say two parts. First, what do you think the most, I mean, the nuns have pretty much risen in every study, in every category. Bradley Wright recently kind of wrote about this in his blog, Black and White and Gray, that's a blog at Pathos, and kind of analyzes. So the nuns pretty consistently, and across all age groups as well, we see the rise of the nuns. Part of my thesis is that's the nominals, those who are having a nominal expression of Christianity. Maybe like my family, we identified as Catholic growing up, but now most of my family just, well, they don't go to church, so they say, we're really nothing. Is it the nominals becoming the nuns? Would you say it's something different, something more? Give us a little picture about where you think these nuns are coming from.
Yeah, and keep in mind that we're talking about N-O-N-E-S. You know, I'll make a speech and say the rise of the nuns, and they think we're talking about Julie Andrews and the Sound of Music with her habit on and so forth.
Right.
The nuns, as we call them, are N-O-N-E-S. Two ways of looking at it. There's no question in all surveys that the trend has been for more people when you call them up or
Okay, we've lost Frank, but we're going to get right back to him in just a second. As such, let me continue the conversation that we're right now discussing about the nuns and really the religiosity in America today. And we're going to continue to look at that. We're going to look at that with Frank Newport in just a moment. The book that we're talking about in his book, God is Alive and Well. And specifically, he talks about the facts are our friends, right? The statistical analysis of what we see related to how Americans answer questions. A couple of things that might be helpful for us to remember. The vast majority of people answer the question of their faith and they say Christian. And Frank's already talked about that. That can be defined very broadly, and statisticians often will combine multiple categories. I recognize that there would be theological nuances, differences. As evangelicals, we tend to count people not by how they answer on a survey, but whether or not they indicate that they have trusted in Christ as Lord and Savior, been born again by the power of his gospel. So we're talking in terms of statistical categories. We're not talking necessarily in understanding where each and every person is or walking the journey of some of the theological nuances I and you and others might want to make. But as such, we're talking about how they answer questions on a poll. And that led Frank and really the Gallup to conclude that God is alive and well. I think the reason that matters is if we don't make that conclusion, and we're really basing this off of erroneous and poorly resourced facts. And the end result is we sort of conclude that we're in this great decline of religiosity when we're not. I think we're right now, Christianity is not collapsing, but it is being clarified. We're getting more clear understanding of what it is of the faith of people in North America today. And with that, part of my thesis is that nominalism is the biggest part that's collapsing, that those who are nominal Christians, those who have been Christians in name only for a long time, are actually now moving away from a Christian commitment and or a Christian identification of any sort, because partly we've lost the cultural value of saying, well, I'm a Christian. It doesn't matter as much anymore. You can say, I'm nothing, and people will still assume you're a good person. 100 years ago, that wasn't the case. If you didn't say, oh, I'm a Christian, or I go to this church or that church, people would assume you're a bad person. There's something wrong with you. Today, that's shifted. Today, you can be religious or non-religious and be accepted in society. So those who were clinging to religiosity so they might be accepted in society are now finding it less and less helpful or advantageous to do so. And the end result is, along the way, that we're losing the identification. But perhaps what I would say is we're not necessarily losing the commitment that we see in many robust Christian churches along the way. So I think it matters that we kind of clarify and have clarity on the categories that we're walking through today. We're hoping to get Frank back and see if I can get an update on that and bring him back into our conversation. But before we do, let's continue to look at a couple of things that may help us to understand some different categories. The way I often count these categories is, and I'll ask one of my staff to let me know what's going on, what we do in our categories is we look at, and I often talk about three categories of Christian. Now, again, I recognize that these are categories of how we count. The first category is what I call, and because they're all C's, right? I'm a pastor by background. I call them census Christians. Now, U.S. Census doesn't ask these questions, but a census is just a large survey, including a full sample. Sample that's everybody. Census Christians answer, I'm a Christian, because they're not another category. They're not in category another religion, not Hindus, they're not Jewish. And so the census Christians. Secondly, there's cultural Christians, and that's sort of related to the two, but they're sort of, you know, engaged. They have some background in Christian faith and things of that sort. Maybe their parents or grandparents were Christian. And then the third category is what I call conversion Christians. And again, these are the Christians that we would say have been, to use Jesus' term, been born again, have been changed by the power of the gospel. And so those three categories kind of make up a pretty broad definition of what Christian is. And so people answer that question differently depending upon who they are, their background, and their understanding along the way. And so what Frank is helping us understand is that we kind of draw from all of those categories when we understand religious commitment that people have. And understanding that, I think, makes a huge difference in understanding how we lay out what's Christian, what's not Christian, and why ultimately it matters. I think what we're going to do is we're going to take a break. And when we come back from our break, we'll hopefully continue our conversation with Frank Newport. So we're going to have a video for you to watch. So take a moment, watch this video. And when we come back, we'll hopefully continue our conversation with him.
Every great story begins with a voice giving shape to darkness. A storyteller speaking characters into existence, and it's good. In fact, it's perfect. Enter the villain, one who wishes to change the story, to bring death to mankind, to unmake the storyteller's good world. inciting incident where everything goes wrong. The villain tells the characters they can create their own story, and they believe the lie. Death is sentenced, and the characters are enslaved. The villain is triumphant. But all is not lost. The storyteller is not idle. He has a plan. But it will take time and sacrifice. The people face extinction. Yet they are not swept away. They face death, but a substitute is given. They face captivity, and the storyteller provides their escape. Yet they remain chained by the villain. But a promise is made. Serpent is lifted high on a staff and brings healing. An unlikely king frees his people. From an ocean tomb comes a message of life, hints of a great rescuer, and then nothing. The story goes quiet. The people fear the storyteller has forgotten his promise. The rescue begins. The storyteller enters the story. He heals the sick, brings hope to the captive. He loves the unlovable. The villain plots his vengeance. He strikes, and the hero's life is given for his people. His promise fulfilled. The substitute is sacrificed. The people are again free. And the hero emerges from his tomb. He gathers his people and sends them out as storytellers. More believe. Their numbers grow. One story told over thousands of years. My story. Your story. His story. This is the Gospel Project.
We are back, and I think we're back with Frank Newport. We're encouraged to hear that news. My apologies for the technical difficulties along the way. Frank, what I want to talk to you about, what I want to hear some about, is this the shifts that we're seeing in faith and part of the understanding of faith. We were talking a little about the nuns, and specifically, where are the nuns coming from? What is the shift that's taking place, and what can we conclude from that? So tell us a little bit more. Just pick up where you left off about the nuns.
There are two points there. One is that I think there's more truth in reporting now. That is, back in the 50s when we called people up and people were what today would be a nun, they still told us Catholic or Baptist or what have you back in the 50s, because that was kind of the social norm, that you said you had a religion. Just like on your dog tag in the Army, you put something down there even if you weren't active at all. And I think today these same exact people, fast forward to today, when we call them up, feel more comfortable in today's environment to say none. They don't have an active religious identity. So I think that's part of what we're seeing, just a difference in reporting. And also, you look at it the other way, a lot of these 18%, they've been looked at a lot. Some of them clearly are totally out of the religious spectrum. There's no question about that. But then some of the people that said they had a religion back in the 1950s were also out of the religious spectrum. But there are people today who say none, who, when you follow up, are what's been called unchurched believers. These are people who still are spiritual, maybe looking for some kind of religion, but just say, I don't have an identity. I was raised a Catholic or I was raised a Presbyterian, but nowadays I just don't have an active religious identity. But that doesn't mean that they're not religious. And that's, I think, an important point to make.
And talk to us a little bit about that there's this rise of spiritual but not religious, a key growing demographic for us to see. As a matter of fact, it's been the fastest growing category, I think, in most polls. I think you've asked that question as well. Might be I'm reflecting on the Pew data. But talk to us about the spiritual but not religious, and what does that mean as an implication for our audience, which is our pastors and church leaders? What does that mean for them, this category?
Well, keep in mind that this is part of what I call the unbranded core, that there are a lot of people out there. This would be the advice for people that are listening right now and watching, is that there are a lot of people out there who have abandoned more formal traditions of religion. And a lot of people know that, of course, because they've looked around the corner and seen large non-denominational Bible churches growing so fast. But there are a lot of people in today's environment, and sociologically, this is part of the whole trend in America today. We're less bound to traditions than we used to be. You know, we connect on Facebook and through social media and do things in a lot different ways than we used to. And the same thing's true with religion. So there are a lot of people out there who may not formally say, I'm a Presbyterian or I'm a Baptist or a Lutheran or a Catholic, but who have interest in religion out there, and they just need to be reached in one fashion or the other. A lot of entrepreneurial, you know, megachurch staff, administration, pastors and so forth have figured this out and are reaching for the group. But and for those in more mainline or traditional churches, I think they obviously are aware of this, but they need to think in the same fashion.
You actually, on several occasions, address mainline churches, and you specifically say they're doing, I'm not quoting exactly, but they're basically doing all the wrong things and able to grow. And you're in a mainline tradition yourself. You attend a PCUSA church there in Princeton. So what is your perception as you sort of look at this as churches are to engage? And why these comments, it might have been some interviews you mentioned this too, why do you think the mainline is missing some of those things?
Yeah, I'll answer that question, some of it a little tongue-in-cheek. But, you know, this is a very sensitive area. I made a speech a few weeks ago and sat next to a Methodist minister, a female Methodist minister, and we were talking more in these kind of marketing terms, as it were, and she, you know, took a little umbrage and said, you know, we're out here to present the Spirit of God and Christ to our people, and that's how we like to look at it, rather than saying we want to be crass marketers. So I know that there is a spectrum out there of people involved in religion about how comfortable they feel thinking about it in these ways. But nevertheless, if people don't think about it in marketing terms, then if their church, denomination, whatever entity we're talking about shrinks down to almost nothing, then that's not doing much good anyhow. So I do think there is some benefit in looking at it in these fashions. And I say tongue-in-cheek to get back to your question, Ed, one thing is mainline Presbyterians don't have enough babies. You know, one way that you grow any group is to have internal reproduction or lots of babies. The Mormons, of course, theologically say let's have lots of babies. They have a theological justification for it, but that has the benefit, of course, of over generations increasing, multiplying the number of Mormons. Look at Mitt Romney and the others who have lots of children. Well, go down do the math. In three or four generations, if each of his children have eight children and each of them has eight children, and if they all stayed at Mormon, then you're rapidly growing the church in that fashion. And the mainline Protestants simply don't have lots of children. Also, there's been no in-migration. One of the problems for Protestants is there's no influx of Protestants from outside the country like there was when the country was founded. One of the salvations for the Catholic Church has been there have been huge numbers of Catholics who've come into the country over the last 30 years, and they've been mainly Spanish-speaking Hispanics, a majority of whom, not all of, mind you, but a majority of whom are Catholic. So the Catholic Church has been buoyed up by having this immigration come in, and the Protestants have been missing out on that front as well. Mainline Protestants also don't do a very good job of conversion or evangelizing. They don't convert a lot of people to their religion either. So you put all that together, and you've got a recipe for a stagnant growth as opposed to a group that has in-migrants, does a good job of converting, and, of course, has lots of babies.
I think statistically we see that kind of across the spectrum, and I like how you sort of look at different faith groups. One of the more fascinating things about you, I just came back from New Orleans, where I preached at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary and Chapel, and your grandfather, I think, was the president, and your great uncle, if I get the connections correctly, is the head of the his name after the Level Center. The Level Center is a place that studies evangelism, church growth, things of that sort. So tell me a little bit about this issue of conversion. It seems that there's a theme. They study that. You've mentioned it a minute ago. there seems to be a lot of, and the Pew did a study this a few years ago, a lot of switching, and that seems to be a great benefit for different movements. Mormons have a lot of converts into their movement. Many Latinos are converting into evangelicalism from Catholicism, particularly to Pentecostalism. So there seems to be this churn, this movement, a significant number of people changing faiths and changing religion. How do you as a researcher both see that and consider how that might matter for the future of faith?
Well, it matters a lot. I wrote an article about it. I got called the religious switcher in America. How's that? A few decades ago, and then there's been a lot of research that's followed up on that. And America is a nation of religious mobility, and one of the reasons, of course, is that we have so many choices. If you're in Spain, you're either a Catholic or a nothing, basically. But in this country, particularly in the Christian faith, non-Catholic Christian faith, we have hundreds and hundreds of choices, and we have this kind of marketing. A lot of people have commented on this, of course. This isn't original thinking, but we have an entrepreneurial kind of marketing view wherein people within denominations will morph their particular churches or parts of churches into certain ways to meet certain needs, and other people's will start a church in a school board, you know, meet in a school auditorium and expand, and it'll be marketed in a different way. So there are lots of choices out there. If I was raised a Presbyterian and got dissatisfied, it doesn't take too much mental, spiritual, philosophic anguish for a Presbyterian to shift over to be a Lutheran or a Presbyterian or a Methodist. They're all in the same general vicinity. And if I'm raised a Baptist, a more conservative Baptist, I can move to a more liberal Baptist church or and so forth and so on. So there's lots of room for choice. And therefore, we have lots of mobility. Now, one of the biggest categories that we've been talking about is people were raised a religion and then shift to where they don't have a religious identity. But other than that, there's a lot of movement back and forth. When I studied it, some of that spousal, you get married, you know, you have two different religious heritages, you have to choose which one you go to usually. That's part of it. I even thought there was, in my analysis, a socioeconomic explanation. If you're born a poor Baptist, poor Pentecostal, and they tend to be poor on average, and then you get rich, then you might say, well, I'm going to go to the Episcopal Church because that's in the rich part of town where I now live, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of reasons behind it. Sure. But clearly, since there is this mobility, again, back to this kind of marketing orientation, a lot of people are available, religiously speaking, if people can reach them in the right ways, because it does. There are not a lot of barriers, as they say in marketing, there are not a lot of barriers to change out there in religion.
All right, you've talked about some of these issues of switching and conversion, et cetera, et cetera. I want to ask you some questions about the relationship of other factors towards religiosity, particularly Christian commitment. Before we do, I want to remind our viewers that if you have questions, you can tweet them using the hashtag The Exchange, or if you're live in the chat room, you can be active. I know it's active there right now, people having conversations. I already have some questions that have come in, and so, but I want to ask one more, and then I'll go to your questions. But again, tweet your questions on Twitter to The Exchange, or engage in the chat room. There seem to be certain correlations between religiosity, particularly Christian commitment, and other factors. You mentioned in the book, you mentioned things like race. You mentioned things like, you more specifically on class. You mentioned politics as well. So in God is Alive and Well, you kind of explore these connections along the way. Talk to us a little bit first about the connection between religion and politics, because one of the things you've said is that religious intensity seems to be correlation with Republican political connection, and with a Democrat is most likely to be the other direction. So tell us a little bit about that statistically. What are you seeing related to party affiliation and religiosity?
Yeah, that's virtually a given in American society today. Just go find the exit polls from November, the presidential election, and in the exit poll they said, how often do you attend church? And just look at the vote choice. If the person said weekly or more than weekly, they fairly strongly voted for Romney. And just go down the church attendance row in the chart. When you get to people who reported they never go to church, they overwhelmingly went for Obama. So there's a strong correlation between religiosity in general and being political party identification and voting, with the highly religious segment being much more likely to be Republican. This is a robust finding, particularly when we look at white Americans, because blacks really confound the analysis because they are the most religious race and ethnic group in America and also the most democratic. So they go totally against the basic trends in society for a variety of fascinating historical reasons. But if you look at non-black Americans, including Hispanics, the more religious they are, generally speaking, the more likely they are to vote Republican. And it's a pretty strong relationship there. So even in the Jewish faith, if the people who are more Orthodox Jews, the strongest Jews, also tend to be slightly more likely to vote Republican, even though as a group, the Jewish vote in America is quite Democratic. So it's a fairly robust finding. I think that may change in the future. You know, there's a lot of interest in this. I point out in the book, I talk about a speech President Obama made at the prayer breakfast in Washington in February of 2012, when he talked about how he thought that a great degree of religious intensity and faith ought to lead one to be a Democrat. Basically, he was saying you ought to be concerned about the poor, injustice, and all the kinds of things that he looked at. He talked about how faith ought to play into politics. And of course, Republicans traditionally have looked more at highly religious people, at more family value issues. Abortion and same-sex marriage is kind of the crux of their relationship to politics. But I think that may expand. I think highly religious people may come more in play, and I point out that in the book, where Democrats are going to come after them and say, look, if you're highly religious, you ought to be a Democrat for these reasons, you know, particularly looking after the poor and trying to solve injustice and some of these kind of social gospel things. So I think that's a fascinating arena that may change this whole relationship in the years ahead. But right now, if you're highly religious, you're more likely to be Republican.
I know that the Obama campaign, particularly the first campaign, really worked hard to sort of bridge some of those gaps. And you know, got widely reported there wasn't that great of a shift among evangelicals who what they voted for. But they're very much, I was at the Washington Post building with the Religion News Writers Association, and they were there. The Obama faith people were there, and they were doing a, you know, explaining what they were doing, how it was working, and finding some high-profile evangelical leaders. So it will be interesting to see if that shift takes place. One of the things that relates to is obviously red states and blue states. And you have a fascinating chapter. Matter of fact, I have to confess, the chapter on state cultures of religion was the most fascinating part for me to get a picture of. And you have this bottom line. And by the way, this is, again, if you're just joining us, this is from God is Alive and Well by Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief of Gallup. Bottom line, you say, this is quoting you, Mississippi is highly religious because it is Mississippi, not because there are a lot of Protestants there. So talk to us a little bit about how geography plays a role in religiosity. And then I want to ask a couple of follow-up questions about that. Talk to us about that.
Well, first of all, there's a huge difference in religiousness by state. You know, there is in politics. There are a lot of things that are very dependent on where you live, but there's a huge difference. I mean, huge. You should see the chart in the book that you're referring to. Hopefully your readers will, where I do all 50 states in rank order by how religious they are. Mississippi is the most religious state in the country. And if you go all the way to the bottom of the chart, Vermont is the least religious state in the country. The least religious areas are New England and the Northwest, Oregon, Washington, Alaska. For some reason, those are the least religious. The most religious areas tend to be in the South, no great shock, the traditional Bible Belt, plus Utah, plus a few other states that are thrown in. Now, what I've tried to look for was reasons for this, and some people say, well, Mississippi is the most religious state in the country, but it also has the highest percent of its population that are African American. And since, as I mentioned a few minutes ago as we were talking here, blacks are the most religious group in America, people say maybe that explains it, but it doesn't. I took out blacks and only looked at whites in Mississippi, and sure enough, they're more religious than whites anywhere else as well. I looked at every group in Mississippi, denomination and otherwise, and they're more religious than elsewhere. So it looks like there's something in the water, so to speak, in Mississippi that causes you to be religious. In Vermont, it's the same way. You look within religious groups, no matter who you are in Vermont, if you're living up there, you're less likely to be religious than elsewhere. Same thing for Catholics. There are not many Catholics in Mississippi, less than 10%, 23% of all Americans are Catholic. But if you find those Catholics in Mississippi, they're less religious than Catholics that they're more religious, excuse me, than Catholics that live somewhere else, like up in New England. So there really is a state cultural hypothesis here, which suggests where you live can affect how religious you are, and that implies if you move to Mississippi tomorrow, you have a higher chance of becoming more religious, and if tomorrow you were to move up to Vermont or to Washington State, you have a chance of becoming less religious.
So it appears that the answer is to get everybody to move to Mississippi if we're desiring to have more people be religious, but maybe not. But talk about that, because part of it is in your book, you make a fascinating connection between health and religion. And so people who are religious are more healthy. And so it appears you're proposing that the government perhaps promote religion. Okay, I'm not really saying that, but you do think that there's a connection between the two. So talk to us about, I mean, we see this. Talk to us about the connection between religion and physical health.
Yeah, the connection between religion and well-being, more broadly defined, is well established in the literature. Not just Gallup, but a number of studies have looked at it. And highly religious people score better on a variety of measures of happiness and not being angry and upset and tranquility and well-being as we measured at Gallup, and also as we measured at health as well. So a lot of researchers have looked at the connection. You know, causality is a big question. Yeah. Some people say, yeah, but that's because people who are happier become more religious rather than the other way around. But there is some research suggesting that people who become more religious actually tend to become happier and have higher well-being as a result. Now, the connection with health is a little more tenuous about causality, but nevertheless, the correlation is still there. And correlation is what insurers use, for example, at businesses. When people, our employees, are given discounts on their health insurance if they show they go to the gym, you know, eight times, at Gallup, that's true. If I can document I go to the gym eight times a month, I get a discount on my health insurance premium. Well, the data suggests that people ought to give the same discount for being religious, because if some employees go to church very frequently, the data would suggest on average they're going to be employees who are happier, have better well-being, better health in some ways, and therefore the hypothesis is, at any rate, they would drain on the health insurance system less than people who are totally non-religious. Now, that's probably not going to fly, but at least it's an interesting connection and a way to think about it, because everybody in this country is worried about well-being and health.
Yeah, I think interesting is a key thing to say. As a matter of fact, throughout this book, you know, I found it fascinating, and a lot of fascinating things, again, the correlations I didn't think about. And again, to define for our audience, you know, think in terms of correlation is going to have some sort of connectedness. They move up and down together on the numbers, where causation means we can evidence that one thing led to the other. And there's a difference, obviously, between the two. We have questions coming in. So let me ask a few of them from our audience that's watching. One of them, do you think that the nuns, this rise of the nuns, is correlated to a specific generation or age category? Or how does this relate as we look across the board, age-wise and otherwise?
That's a good question. We continue to look at it. By the way, it's slowing down a little in our data, not getting as high. The people who are most likely to be nuns are the younger generation. So it's complex because, and I have a good, in fact, one of my most important chapters is on the relationship between age and religion, because that's very well defined about how you dip down to the least religious Americans are age 23, and that comes back up significantly, levels off in the 40s, and really zooms through the roof after about age 60 and 65, and that has a lot of implications. So the nuns are skewed down in that younger group, and there's research that shows that may be increased. You know, the increase tends to be more of those young people who are nuns than previous generations. But if we look back in the data, in answer to the question, 50s, 60s, 70s, the people that are most likely to have no religious identity were also young back then as well. Right. So it is a phenomenon that's more in the young. But the jury's out a little more on exactly those complex interactions between age groups over time and so forth.
Right. And one of the things that there people assume, and I think your book actually does agree with this assumption, is that as people age, they become more religious. At least we can snapshot that there's religiosity present at higher levels, depending upon the age bracket and age category, which again, one of the more fascinating chapters in your book is the relationship of age and religion. Talk to us a little bit about that, but also your thesis that this bodes for, as the boomers get older, for perhaps a more robust religious commitment in America as well. So talk to us first about the connection between the two, and then what does that mean for the future?
Absolutely. It's the baby boomers. That's the real key. We know cross-sectionally, decade after decade, that the most religious people are about 65 and over. Fact number two, the number of 65 and over Americans is going to double in the next 20 years. Is this huge group of baby boomers, that includes me, people born between 1946 and 1964, aged to be 65 and over. And so point three is, does that mean that this huge group of people will become more religious just like their parents and their grandparents were before them? And that's the open question. Yeah. Will they too become more religious, or are baby boomers going to blow the usual pattern and not get more religions as they age? There's data, I think, which suggests it's more likely the baby boomers will get more religious in some ways as they age. And if that's the case, that means we're going to have a huge group of people who are more religious than they were before, and therefore the overall average religiosity in the country is going to go up. We'll wait and see.
Yeah,
you know, we got to monitor year by year. We know we baby boomers are going to blow the Social Security system out of the water. We're going to blow Medicare. We're going to do a lot of things as we get old, but including helping the travel industry, because a lot of us want to travel as we get older. But I think that it bodes well for religion that you're going to have this doubling of older people out there who will be seeking some kind of spirituality and religion.
Yeah, the I'm a little bitter about you baby boomers. I'm not a baby boomer. I'm a little bitter about what you're doing to so many of these institutions, economic and elsewise, otherwise. But I do think there's a potential, and our pastors and church leaders who are watching this, you don't want to discount the baby boomer generation as an opportunity to still be reached. And we do see that shift. Historically, we've seen the increasing engagement in religion along the way. So that's a key issue. Let's talk about this issue of religion and non-religion. Particularly, there's been a real enthusiastic conversation about atheism in not just the United States, but in really the world, but in the West, in the English-speaking world, some more aggressive atheists. And there's been a consistent claim that atheism is on the rise, atheism is growing in influence, and certainly it's growing in publishing influence, but you don't see a great statistical growth in the number of atheists here. Where do you see atheism sort of pressing in the statistics?
Well, you know, that's an excellent point. The percent of Americans who believe in God, and I think that's one way to look at it, is still above 90%, and that's where it's been historically. Maybe down a few points, but we still don't see a precipitous drop in the percent of Americans who believe in God. People conflate this idea of the rise of the nuns with the rise of atheism, but the two aren't correlated. So even today, in our last surveys, over 90% say they believe in God. And therefore, we're not a nation of atheists, as some would claim. You know, the famous book by Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, doesn't so much claim that we have a rise in atheists, and he's one of the about atheists you're talking about. He just claims those people who still believe in God are deluded. He's saying, well, here's all the reasons that they're stupid and don't know what they're doing. Well, that's pretty arrogant, of course, to believe that these tens of millions and hundreds of millions of people are all deluded. But nevertheless, that's his claim.
And let's talk about the deluded claim. One of the things that, you know, Gallup has been the standard that I've used when I talk about church attendance. But we also know there's been discussion. You've answered this question before, both in the book and elsewhere. And by the way, the book, again, is God is Alive and Well by Frank Newport. I want to encourage you to pick it up. But the Gallup has consistently reported a church attendance rate that some people have questioned. I think Hadaway and Marler wrote in the I think it was I'm trying to remember which journal it was. I think it was a journal for the Academy of Scientific Study of Religion. They said, well, you know, we look at this and we actually measure. They took a smaller geographic region in Ohio and said, you know, they say they attend this rate, but they attend at a lower rate. I know you've answered this before, but share with folks, how would you say what percentage of Americans are attending church, and how would you deal with the argument that a lot of that's a halo factor, that people are sort of overestimating their church attendance?
Yeah, that's been looked at a lot. Fascinating research. The research you're talking about was in Ashtabula County, northwest Ohio, where they did a survey, and then they went out and got a census of everybody who was in church and couldn't find warm bodies in churches that matched the percentage you said they generally go to church, and so forth. We have about 40%, give or take which measure we're using, of Americans who say they're regular church attenders. And quite a bit more who say they're seldom, but do attend, just not as frequently. And that's been questioned a lot. There have been some diary studies when people aren't told that this is about religion at all. Just keep a diary of everything you do every day, 7 days a week, that shows a smaller percent going to religious services and so forth. That's probably true. There is probably some over-reporting. I think the trends, though, are very important, because whether they go up or down would carry that same over-reporting with. And there's been some recent research that shows self-reported church attendance is actually a pretty good measure of religiosity, whether or not it's totally valid or not, because if somebody wants to tell an interviewer they attend regularly, that means they probably are quite religious, even if they don't actually, if you had a video camera and followed them around, don't go quite as often as they say they go. And some of the other reaction to it, George Gallup Jr. here used to say, well, people are worshiping in Bible study groups and in their living rooms in various places that you don't catch in a traditional way. So I think that this how often do you go to church measure, or did you attend religious services in the last 7 days? It's a pretty good measure of religiosity. Again, even if we grant that, if we followed everybody who said they went weekly with the video camera, we probably wouldn't find them in church every week.
Yeah, good. And I think it is helpful stat, and particularly to watch it. Well, first of all, not tanking, as maybe some have assumed listening to the breathless reports. And so I think that's why I find your book so helpful, is that it's not an anecdotal, I think, or I see, but it's really based upon some very strong interviews over a long period of time. The book, again, is God is Alive and Well by Frank Newport. Again, Frank, kind of in closing, take just a moment and share with us why you paint what I find to be, compared to many of the doomsday reports, kind of an encouraging picture of the future of faith in America in particular. So in closing, why don't you just share that with us? Because again, pastors and church leaders are listening, trying to understand, try to think about the culture and how they might engage it. We believe facts are our friends. And so what facts would you see that point to a bright future for faith in America?
Well, I think that there are a number of them that show religion still very viable in this country. The reasons I think it might actually become more viable, one is a major one is age, because I see this older group that has the potential to be more religious. So I think that's a significant factor that could increase overall religiosity. I think the well-being data we talked about may become better known, and I think Americans may recognize in kind of a rational framework that religion is actually good for them. Not only with the relationship with God and Jesus Christ within the Christian church that is traditionally talked about for the Christian segment, or the relationship to whatever, you know, the other gods in the Islamic religion or Jewish religion. But nevertheless, people will recognize that just from a practical perspective, it's good for them to be religious. You know, there's some benefits from it. I think we're having more migration to more religious states. The data show that. And therefore, that has the potential to increase religiosity as well. And I think the whole spectrum of how religion's manifested through the political arena and things like that's going to become more visible and more discussed. And I think that makes religion more vibrant. If the Democrats start actively going after religion and talking about religion and reaching it to try to counter the Republicans' kind of hammer hold on it, then that's good overall, because it means religion's being discussed more actively. So those are some of the reasons that I think at least the potential is there that the country could be more religious in ways, maybe different ways. You know, everything changes, unbranded ways, other ways. But I think the potential is there for America to be as religious or more religious in the future.
Frank, thank you for taking the time to talk with us, talk with our audience. We appreciate it. We appreciate the research you do. It challenges us, causes us to think. And so we're going to take a break. When I come back, I'm going to just have Q&A and answer the rest. This is going to end Frank's time with us today, but we appreciate it, and we appreciate Gallup. Take a moment, watch this, and we'll be back after a minute, and we'll continue our conversation. Again, thank you to Frank Newport.
Words can't unleash the very creative nature that God has put in every individual. And it is a huge responsibility to pay attention to words, because words do matter. At B&H Publishing, we're 100 people. We're a small team. And because of that, we're fully a team. So we bring the strength of every competency, every experience, all the talent that comes around shaping content. Because we're small, we're agile. We can speak into all the process. We can come around an author and a message together. Last year alone, there were over 1 million books published. A lot of noise. But at B&H, we want to take that noise, and we want to be intentional and purposeful in the content that we produce. We don't want to do 1 million books. We want to do a few books. A few books on purpose, that we have a vision that content will give people hope and encouragement, transform their lives, help them to be all that God has created them to be. The barriers are down. The opportunity's here. We want to be innovative in how we think about that. We really have a vision for reaching the entire world. And it is exciting. It is challenging. I mean, words, the ability to take those to all parts of the culture where people live has never been greater. Every word matters, because words have the power to build up or to tear down. Words have the power to encourage or to discourage, to give hope and life or to bring death.
God has a great story to tell.
God has a great story to tell.
And He's telling it through people.
Through the lives of people every day.
Every word matters.
Every word matters.
Every word matters.
Every word
matters.
At B&H, every word matters.
And we're back here at The Exchange. Frank Newport joined us as our guest, and now I'm sort of following up with some of the Q&A that came in. He had another meeting he had to go to, was gracious enough to give us his time. Again, the book we discussed with Frank is called God is Alive and Well, and it's really pretty fascinating. It's worth you taking the time to get a read for it along the way. It says, religion is as powerful and influential as it's ever been in American society. Now, several questions have come in. For example, what does it mean to be religious? And some of them are about terminology. And so the conversation that I had with Frank was obviously a conversation between statisticians. And actually, I'm not a statistician. I'm a missiologist. But we have statisticians that work for us, and Frank is a statistician. And when you define religious or religiosity, it has to do with participation in religious activity, commitment, faith, etc. And so when Frank is talking about religiosity of Americans, we're not talking about everyone being a Christian in that. You heard that conversation about Judaism, for example, and other parts of religious expression in America today. His book is not about Christians per se, but about faith and faith being alive and well in America today. So again, if you have questions, if we're live, you can tweet these in. I'll try to answer as many as I can. There's several good ones here, for example, along the way. One of the questions is, why does Gallup classify Mormons as a Christian denomination? I'll tell you, pretty much everybody who does research from a secular perspective classifies Mormons as a Christian denomination. Pretty much every statistician, every poll, every map you see that divides up will classify Mormons as Christians. And really will classify just within the category of anybody who claims to be Christian would be in that category. So you'd see Catholic, Orthodox, as in Eastern Orthodox, which includes the different C's of Orthodoxy. You'd see Mormons and Protestants, Pentecostals and mainline Protestants, all in one category. So it's important to know that when you're having a conversation about statistics, that's often the case. I'm about to run an interview on my blog with Philip Jenkins, who's well known for his study of Christianity around the world. And again, all those categories are lumped together in many. Now again, we would nuance that, right? As an evangelical, I would define Christian as one who's been changed by the power of Christ, who's been transformed, who's been what Jesus called was born again. And so that category is used differently by evangelical believers, and I think rightfully so. And I would use that category differently. But when we have research conversations, it's a different conversation along the way. All right, so here are some other questions that have sort of come in and I want to address along the way. Is there any evidence that the nuns have increased due to the perception of conflict or potential conflict within religious organizations? There's all kinds of lists of reasons that people have dropped out. I'd want to direct you to a book by Essential Church by Tom Rainer and Sam Rainer. And it, based on some research we did here at Lifeway Research, why people drop out. In other words, they attended church for at least twice a month as a high schooler, freshman, sophomore, junior, or senior year. And then they drop out of church for at least a year in their subsequent years. And one of the things we found is, yes, one of the categories that they described as part of the reason they dropped out of church was conflict. Now, that was not the number one category. The number one category they indicated they dropped out was related to their busyness. They just got too busy for church. Now, we recognize that busyness is often too busy for something is a statement of priorities. You know, I'm not too busy to spend time with my wife because I value and appreciate her and our relationship. So again, we recognize that busyness is a statement of value, and that's a statement of commitment. But the reality is conflict's not the biggest issue. One of the perceptions that people have in churches today is that the reason so many people are deciding not to come to church is because they have a negative perception of Christians. Brad Wright, in his helpful book, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Led to Believe, gives us a better look at that. It's not that they're spending a lot of time thinking negatively about us. It's that they're not thinking about us much at all. And I think that gives us an opportunity, maybe a more blank slate than many Christians realize, to share the gospel with people along the way. Another question is, could the rise of nuns be more of a rise of apathy? I think it's more of a rise of honesty and not necessarily apathy. Now, I think apathy is probably part of it. But I think there's a swath of American self-identified Christians who say, I'm a Christian. Which, depending on who you ask, how you ask the question, 70-80% of people will say in the United States that they're a Christian. It's a little lower, but not much lower in Canada. a little lower, but not even much more lower in Australia and England. And so you find this the vast majority of people in English-speaking countries identify as Christian. But what you find is that doesn't mean a lot to them. Is there's this robust, if you want to divide it into categories, there's a chunk of people in the who are just not Christians. They meet that category. We're not in the believer category. And there's a chunk of people who are sort of in another category that would say, I'm a robust believer. It's that squishy middle. That squishy middle is filled with people who identify as Christian because they don't have anything else to identify as. They don't want to identify as an atheist. What if they're not sure? They don't want to identify as an agnostic. That sounds kind of wimpy. And so what they identify with is, I'm a Lutheran because I when I grew up, my parents were Lutheran. You know, I was recently sharing Christ with a neighbor, and they explained to me, you know, I'm Catholic. And I said, well, tell me about that. And he said, well, as a child, I was baptized. And that was really the totality of their identification, but they still identify as Catholic today. And part of that, maybe they're still in the church role. You know, I'm still in the church role of the church I was baptized in as an infant oh so long ago on Long Island. And so part of it, maybe they're still on that church role as a Catholic. But part of it is there's just simply, they were nominal Catholics, nominal Christians, nominal Protestants, whatever. The nominals are increasingly becoming the nuns. So I don't think it's directly driven by the issue of apathy, but more driven by the just getting honest. And I think that's a good thing. I kind of long for a day in the West when being a Christian means something more than not being a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu. But being a Christian means a robust faith commitment that you've been changed by the power of the gospel, and that changes is everything. Another question is this, and I'll probably take one more. If you want to tweet one in last minute or send in the chat room, we'll go for it. It says, does the increase of the nuns parallel the increase in our population increase, meaning our current reaching models are just not able to reach the current population? No. The increase of the nuns is outpacing the increase of our population. It's, in other words, it's a percent of the population as a whole. And again, you might want to read the blog I mentioned earlier. Bradley Wright's blog is Black, White, and Gray. It's a Pathos blog. And in there, he traces out the rise of the nuns in pretty much all age groups. It's highest. The highest age group is the youngest. But it's pretty much going up in all age groups. And again, I'm not panicking about that, right? Why? Because there are more people who identify with evangelical connected denominations and churches today than there were in 1972. Because sometimes people identify as born again, as up and down, but has not seen this large drop-off. So I do see robust evangelicalism. I see hemorrhaging Protestant, mainline Protestantism, and I see the nominals becoming the nuns. And so when we look to the future of faith, I think the future of faith, and I wrote this in the USA Today article that I mentioned when I talked to Frank, I think the future of faith looks a lot like the Pacific Northwest. The example I gave was the Northwest District of the Forster Square Church, which has planted dozens of new churches in the last 20 years, which has seen tens of thousands of new believers in the last 20 years in a community, in a society that's largely post-Christian, largely driven more by tolerance than it is by truth. And yet in the midst of that, we see a robust gospel expression going forth. So thank you again for joining us on this edition of The Exchange. As always, these shows are broadcast live every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Central Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, and then really around the world, you can join us. And then we'll archive these as always at edstetzer.com/The Exchange. Or just go to edstetzer.com and you can click on The Exchange link there. So thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you next week as we continue our conversation with ministry leaders, learning about what it means to press forward together. Next week, I'll be with Johnny Moore, and we'll broadcast live from Liberty University. We hope to see you then. God bless.